everybody has some sort of a history and call to action, and ours happened to be right around the time we became parents. And I was at home, and I had a new child, and I was listening to a lot of KGNU and Democracy Now!, and I was I started reading labels more closely, specifically just because I had a new child, and found that you know, a lot of the body care products had parabens and alcohol and perfumes, and I was a little neurotic, and started to just make my own. And that was my introduction into working with herbs, really, was at home for several years, making teas and tinctures and salves and body balms and things like that. And then in 2000 and maybe 2008, I was approached by somebody who asked me to make a cannabis topical because he'd been on Vicodin for so long that literally a Tylenol was dangerous. His liver couldn't take it. And so I was able to get Trim at that time and manufactured basically a diaper ointment without zinc and using cannabis instead. And it was really profound in many ways, and that person still uses it. It's a topical. It's not psychoactive. It was the first product we ever made. It's still on our menu. And I think after that, there was a feeling of some sort of social obligation to share what I had seen and what I had learned. It was really life-changing.
Was that a pain-relieving topical ointment? What did it do?
It was just pain relief. It worked for him as well as the steroids that they were trying to put him on. So that was a big moment for me, and that, you know, changed things. That was a big thing to witness and to be a part of. And that kicked off sort of my exploration into cannabis. And I bought some really expensive textbooks and was reading about, you know, the endocannabinoid system. And I was being exposed on both sides from a global perspective point of view that I'd really never exposed myself to, just too busy, head down working. And on the other side, learning about this crop, this commodity, this fiber, and those two things started to line up in a way that was really unique, especially coming from the DARE community and growing up in the South and not being exposed to cannabis at all.
What community?
DARE. If you grew up in the 80s and 90s, you probably were exposed to the DARE program, which was the DARE to keep kids off drugs. So it was just a lot of fear and ignorance around what this was. And so, you know, being exposed to some of these global issues like incarceration or hunger, pollution, suffering, war, there is a substantial answer in this plant for all of these, you know, seemingly overwhelming problems. And it was surprising, a little uncomfortable, especially with, you know, being on the playground with young kids and the conversation about what do you do. That was always a little tricky in the beginning. It's old hat now almost and expected in Boulder, but and so it just became a natural progression from there. The more I learned, the more I wanted to learn, the more that I made and experimented and saw, the more I'd want to make and experiment and see. And over the course of years, we developed a menu working out of that dispensary in Boulder that was customized with the genetics that we were growing, with the ingredients that we were using. So without really knowing it, we were doing terpene research and we were doing this genetic research and we were working with patients that had everything from autoimmune or insomnia or different types of, you know, ailments that we would pair up with not just cannabis, but other herbs and other ingredients like cayenne pepper and spirulina.
So do you have a recreational side to the business or is it purely medicinal?
So for licensing purposes, we have what's called dual, which means we provide both medical dispensaries and recreational dispensaries. For the farm stand and our outlet store that just opened, it's a recreational only store, but we offer medical patient discounts.
So what have been some of the major challenges as a marijuana cannabis business owner in Colorado, given the passage of the legislation has opened the door, but there's a massive web of regulations that you have to navigate? What has that been like?
Sure. You know, Colorado has been, I think, they've been outstanding in their approach to making this available and honoring the will of the voters, and it's been challenging on all fronts. And there's a lot of compassion that goes both ways, I think, from the industry and our regulatory body. There's not, as far as regulation goes, you know, it's not that different from if you were maybe selling houses or securities or working with merchant services. So it's not a totally new ball game when it comes to code. However, it's big. You know, you have so many different types of businesses and licenses, and and it grows fast. So I find that the most challenging is interpretation, or maybe not being able to get an answer in writing, or that all of the code isn't in one place. When you cite code, you're frequently also looking at memos and bulletins in an amalgamated notebook that you keep like a Bible with all your notes in it. It can be really challenging to get answers or clarification because frequently it's just too new.
And then also you're dealing with state regulation and local regulation. Now you're in Boulder.
I am, but as a distributor, I'm dealing with everybody's code, because if I'm delivering to, say, Boulder, who has tamper evident requirements, but Denver does not, it doesn't really matter where I'm located. You need to make sure that the products you deliver are compliant in every municipality, and those change.
And so are you getting audited? Are you getting inspected? I mean, how do you know that you're keeping up with this? And how does the state know and the local authorities know that you're in fact keeping up with all of these different requirements?
It seems that generally you don't get a lot of attention unless you're doing something out of line. So a lot of times you're just hopeful that you're doing it the right way. And it's not until something does go wrong that they find out you're doing a lot of things off, or your fonts are too small, or your signs are too big. But otherwise, you just have to keep up with it. As new things come out and they issue new code change, you know, you have to stay on top of it and be current.
Now, you said the state has done a really good job in terms of establishing these different regulations. What areas, though, do you see improvement could happen?
Standards need to be implemented. I think that the yardstick has to be the same. That's really challenging for businesses, particularly those that are operating off of an eco-friendly model. If you are on the medical side, for example, no testing is required. So for potency, you could be labeling with active THC, which is the commodity. It's the psychoactive component. It's how people should understand their product and understand, you know, for consumer safety. However, you could have a product that's labeled with how much trim was used or how much hash was used, which frankly is like telling you how many grapes are in your wine. It's not helpful information. It can really actually do more damage, because now people think that they have a significantly higher tolerance than maybe they do. And also just for shopping. You know, there's a lot of patients who are coming here to get things like CBD products. So if you're spending $60 or $80 for a CBD product on the medical side and it's not tested, it's a gamble. And then a lot of those folks don't necessarily get the best medicine or the best desired effect. And then we lose them. They all go back to Vicodin or whatever was their alternative before they chose cannabis to begin with. So it's really important that we all present this in a way that's transparent and that's clean and clear and understandable, because it's a new widget. Everybody loves this widget, but 70 years of prohibition has limited our understanding of how to buy it, what to look for, and how to read a label.
Are there efforts to change that, to have that standardization across the board?
What's available to us right now, there are lab tests that you can purchase for pesticides, for example. And as a model, the Growing Kitchen implemented this last summer when the recalls started and this pesticide issue sort of came to light, because people started to test for it. Once people started to test for it, I spoke to a few of the lab directors. Ian Behringer from RM3 Labs is an outstanding industry pioneer, and he's guided our SOPs from the beginning. Peter Perrone from Gobi Analytics was the one who provided us lab tests in the summer, who's the one who alarmed me so much. It was after speaking to him and him telling me he couldn't believe the parts per million that he was seeing on these concentrates in particular, because the potency or the pesticides were also being concentrated down, and he had absolutely no recourse, even though he tested it at whatever it was. He had no choice but to give it back. He couldn't keep licensed product. And there were people that were being, products were being recalled in Denver and then being sold in Boulder. And it was just a mess. And so as a standard, the Growing Kitchen began our testing standardization in the summer that basically just follows state law as it's written. It's just not implemented yet. So consumers can look for lab tests on the back of a product. And if it says pesticide non-detect, then it's been tested and there's less than one part per million of any detectable pesticides. What's unfortunate is that the standards between the labs that we're allowed to use, like Gobi Analytical, and the lab that the Denver Health Department or that the state uses are different. So you could pass one and fail the other. So even if you were doing everything that you could technically be subjected to a recall. And if you weren't doing everything that you could, there's no consumer safety for that right now. And frankly, it's one of the most dangerous times to buy product, because when they announce new code, say for the medical side, that you're going to start testing for things like residual solvents, which makes sense, right? In an immunocompromised community, you'd want to test for things like carcinogens. So if you tell everybody that you have 6 months to get your act together, during the course of these last 6 months, the market's been flooded with product that won't sell in a few months. And that's also
because
been,
they know it won't pass muster.
Right. So I can either give it away now or I can throw it away later. And they're giving it away, which has driven the price down. And it's made it incredibly difficult, again, for people who are processing and using these standards already.
This must be incredibly difficult for consumers to navigate, particularly medicinal marijuana consumers. As mm-hmm. you said, if they're immunocompromised or they're taking medical marijuana for, you know, a particular illness that makes them more susceptible, you know, to any kind of pesticide exposure. And yet there's no standard. I mean, so do you get people coming in and just relying on your expertise? I mean, how does this work for consumers?
Honestly, I think that by the time anybody knows what happened, it will be over. So as a consumer right now, I think the best thing you could do, you know, is understand this the way you'd understand any other purchase and try to use conscious consumerism and vote with your dollars. If there's a company available that's providing information or going above and beyond or bending over backwards for these safety guidelines, then it's better to than asking for what's the cheapest gram when you walk into a dispensary. We all have this part to play as a manufacturer. You want us to do a good job as far as providing good product and taking care of our staff and our resources. You need middlemen that have, you know, scruples and standards and toe the line as far as what they vote with their dollars for. And then you need an educated consumer that, again, is completing that cycle of good business.
We're speaking with Brooke Wise, who's one of the founders of The Growing Kitchen. She's the CEO of that. It's a local Boulder cannabis business. And they, in 2015, were the recipient of The Cannabists, which is the Denver Post's cannabis blog, their eco-friendly award. And as we're hearing, Brooke actually got into cannabis and tinctures and salves because of her own concerns as a new mom around chemicals and parabens and various different things in creams and other products. We're talking here on KGNU about some of the barriers facing businesses. I mean, what do you see as your biggest barrier as you're trying to navigate the regulation, the lack of standardization on all of this, state regulation being a little bit different from local authority regulation here in Boulder? I mean, what are some of the biggest challenges for you as a business owner in the cannabis industry?
Well, you know, you're growing frequently at a rapid rate without standard business resources. Banking is still a challenge.
Yeah, so what do you do with your money? I mean, do you have a bank account? Can you actually
make
deposits?
The truth about banking is that I feel like right now the vast majority of the market is still playing the game of however many bank accounts a year. Sometimes you go through 20 or 30 bank accounts a year. As soon as one gets closed, you transfer money as fast as you can. And that seems to be the model, if you can believe that. I, for a while, have saved all these different debit cards and cancellation letters. You know, it's a wall of history for us because we're certain that there will be a time that's funny history, right? So for banking, most people do that. There are a very limited availability of accounts through banks that will, without wanting to throw too much shade, because we're grateful for the availability of the bank account, but unfortunately we don't get a standard bank account. It frequently comes at an incredibly high price for no cash services, no payroll services, no courier services. Literally just to be able to hold an account can cost as much as $20,000 a year.
Why? I mean, what do they have specific very expensive accounts just for cannabis businesses?
They do. And they'll point to the additional man hours that come with the oversight and greasing the wheels with the, I mean, everybody's. But the point is that that's an unfair challenge for an industry that's fledgling, that's new, that has so far demonstrated enormous contributions, both economically and to society. And as far as a community business goes, I think that we should be doing everything that we can to lift this up and to see how positive and powerful it can be. And without things like basic banking services, it's, you know, on the inside and in the industry, it's a big laugh to us that here we are being forced to stamp brownies or some regulation that really just trips up business and raises prices. And we know that the pendulum will swing the other way and deregulation is right around the corner from here. But for the time being, there is no greater public safety threat than a multi-billion-dollar industry with no banking service.
So how do you do with simple things like paying taxes, paying payroll, when you have just the very basic banking services available to you?
It's not easy. You know, you'll see fabulous people like Sally from Medicine Man with an armed guard outside of her office when she's doing payroll, because it's all in cash for sometimes hundreds of people.
So how do, as a company, how as a business, do you even grow with that? You know, can you get a mortgage if you wanted to acquire more space to expand? I mean, are you, does this ripple out into just all aspects of your business?
It's, you know, it's a hurdle that you began with. So you sort of have taken it in as part of your model. You deal with a lot of cash. You deal with a lot of stigma. You deal with a lot of jokes. You deal with a lot of uphill battles. But the winning side, I mean, there are people that we see on a regular basis who no longer take prescription medicine, or who no longer use crutches, or who are drinking fresh pressed cannabis juice instead of taking steroids. And it's a big win. And to see the land out there being developed in a way that's sustainable and it's a positive model is exciting. This is the end of prohibition, and it's a big deal to be a part of it and to be shaping that. And I think most of us have resigned ourselves to the fact that you don't get to be a trailblazer if the path is already laid. So this is part of what we've all signed up for. But we still obviously have to keep talking about it. We don't have access to a bank. We don't have access to standard lab practices. We don't have access to some of the services that would legitimize this business more than anything else.
Do you see the decriminalization of marijuana and cannabis happening at a federal level anytime soon that will open the doors to many of these or will lift up the barriers that sure. many of these barriers that we're talking about? Because really what's happening is we can have all these laws passed, as many as we want in Colorado, but really because of the federal prohibition, that's where the banking issue is coming in. That's where a lot of the other problems are happening.
Yeah, it's a big deal. It's going to affect a lot of levels. I think the writing is on the wall, right? It's interesting too how in lockstep the end of prohibition for cannabis mirrors the end of prohibition for alcohol, starting in Colorado, starting with distilleries, starting with medical cards. I mean, really top to bottom, it's comical how closely aligned that is. Colorado was the first there too. So it seems to me that history does repeat itself, and that the writing is on the wall. And, you know, the money alone seems to be a massive catalyst for other states entertaining ideas or putting initiatives on the ballot. So whatever the reason is for different areas, it seems like more and more places are talking about it, and it's gained a huge amount of momentum. The question seems not to be if as much as when, that this will be the normal.
Now, you and your husband started this very much as a grassroots thing, making the salves and the tinctures and the various different products at home, and now it has grown, and you are the growing kitchen. Now, what do you say to people who think that this is just a cash cow? People are moving to Colorado, making tons and tons of money off of this industry. Because I've spoken to small business owners like yourself who have moved in from a variety of other businesses into cannabis. And they're like, there are so many, I don't want to say barriers, but challenges that you're not going to walk in the door and just get stinking rich really fast.
Right. Or if they do, I'd like to know how. there's more work to be had than money right now. There's a lot of work to shape this. But it's exciting because we all have the opportunity to put our fingerprints on this. And with hard work and with good communication and foundations and leaving something behind that's better than how we found it, we have the opportunity to really do something powerful and important together. And that's what I say. You know, there's work to be done. If you want to roll up your sleeves and do work, there's plenty of sunshine for everybody. And there is money to be made. It is lucrative. It is a booming business, especially for folks that are playing a longer game.
How many employees do you have?
We have about 15 full-time employees now.
That's big. And so you have to navigate other things like healthcare and all of this. And so how do you work in just the regular business model on top of the cannabis regulations?
We're fortunate to have an outstanding team of folks who, like we just talked about, are dedicated and believe in it and believe that their time is well spent, that they're a part of the solution every day. And they work with a lot of heart and conviction. And that has made that challenge easier. And you're right, it's a large operation. It's a 16,000 square foot manufacturing facility on 25 acres of organic land in Boulder County. And you know, one of the things that really served us well, because you do grow really fast, which is just going to create growing pains no matter what. And you're frequently having to figure it out as you go. There's no template to follow, right? Nobody's ever done this before. So you're thinking critically every day and literally problem solving all the time. And one of the things that I rely on frequently is our brand and our branding choices. We decided a long time ago that there was just only one kind of business we wanted to be a part of. And that's freed us up to not have to ask a lot of questions as we work through. Of course we offer maternity leave. It's not even up for discussion. Of course we offer benefits and we feed our staff every day, twice a day. And of course we recycle and compost. And because those were branding decisions from the inception, we've never really had to stop to ask ourselves how we'd move forward. We've just taken that with us the whole way. And it's been really liberating, to be honest. I think it's freed us up more than it's weighed us down, even though those are expensive investments.
So when you have employees, now you have 15 full-time employees, given that this is a newly legalized industry, are you looking for people with experience? Are you just looking for people with interest? I mean, how do you even go about the hiring process, mm-hmm. given that legally most people should not have experience working with cannabis?
Right. Well, you know, I actually love to train people. I think that it's great when they come new and excited and eager to learn. There's no problem there. And, you know, technically, cannabis as a legal entity and industry has been around in Colorado since 2000. And, you know, we always are looking for people who want to lift this up. It's a lot of work. And we found outstanding relationships with people through, like, the Green Labs event group in Denver has been a great catalyst for community involvement, engagement, connecting different people and skill sets together to both shape and serve the industry, but also present it in a way that's palatable, because this is who we are.
What is it like being a woman in this industry? Because there seems to be a lot of women in charge of various different cannabis businesses. Is this something that we're seeing more women moving into this area, do you think?
You know, my experience seems to be more with men. I think that the women that are in the industry are largely behind the scenes, and that could be part of why. But there are some outstanding women in the industry that have done a lot to apply those values and to balance it out a little. But that almost makes me think it's part of just a larger shift in general, with more women in the workplace and more women in C-level positions. And I don't know if it's how it really, I don't know if we know enough yet to know what the impact on this industry alone. But as a woman in the industry, it's frequently very funny. it's frequently a lot of fun. And we're all learning together.
So you are growing a lot of your own product. Are you growing all of the product that you sell?
Yeah. So what's special and unique about our facility, whether you buy our products in a retail store all over the state, medical or recreational, or whether you visit us now at our new public location, which is all in one facility, what's special about what we're doing is every single product that we manufacture, whether it's just smokable flower, concentrates, any kind of inhalant, oral or topical products, everything is grown by us at that farm. Everything is grown outside under the sun, mostly without a structure, for our infused products. And then for our flower, we also have indoor hydroponic gardens as well. None of our products are manufactured with just the trim or waste that most infused products are manufactured with. They're all made with the whole plant, which means you get the entire entourage effect of all the cannabinoids and not just THC. So they taste better, they last longer, they feel stronger. And then in addition, we're the only license in the entire state as of the time of creating these procedures, the only license that's testing for pesticides on our products prior to sale. So, and you ask me, how do you know you're pesticide free? I say, well, because we grow it all ourselves. We're not collecting trim from everybody all over the state and then making brownies in one giant batch. We're actually growing small batches ourselves. And then we're testing it prior to sale so that consumers can actually see that for themselves.
Well, is there anything else you think listeners should know about the cannabis industry in general, either here in Colorado or what we're seeing at a federal level, given in this election year, we are going to see more states having this as an issue on their election in November?
Sure. I would say, you know, it's happening. So whether you're a fan or not, it's not a bad idea to educate yourself about what it is, whether it's because you want to find it or want to avoid it. I also think that if you're interested in just what industry and business looks like in your neighborhood, it's important to be aware that these businesses are growing, and with good stewardship, they can grow to be contributing and impactful focal points of our communities that give back and give more than they take. But it comes at the price of informed decisions and learning how to read a label and finding brands that represent your values and making those purchasing choices.
Well, Brooke Wise with Growing Kitchen, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Maeve.